This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 11th of June, these are our main stories. Officials in Mali say about 100 people have been massacred in a village in the central Mopti region. 10 Conservative MPs have put their names forward to succeed Theresa May as party leader and Prime Minister of Britain. The Vatican has rejected the idea that people can choose their gender, calling it an attempt to annihilate nature. Also in this podcast, a wine from the Battle of Hastings in, of course, 1066, that we still enjoy today. We begin this podcast in the West African nation of Mali, where officials are estimating that at least 100 people have been killed in a massacre at a village in the central Mopti region. It's the latest massacre to destabilise central Mali, where the government is struggling to contain violent intercommunal clashes. The Mopti district is home to the Dogon people, an ethnic group famed for their picturesque, densely built, mud-walled villages, distinctive ceremonial masks and unique culture. Clashes between Dogon hunters and semi-nomadic Fulani herders are frequent. Officials say many of the dead were badly burned in the attack. Homes were also burned and animals killed. I found out more from our Africa editor, Mary Harper.
A local official said that it was members of the Fulani ethnic group who are pastoralists who've been fighting with the Dogon, especially this year. There's been huge massacres. One minute you'll hear of 150 Fulani being killed by Dogon hunters, and then you'll hear of 120 Dogon people being killed by Fulani nomads. So this is a cycle of violence that has really come to the fore this year. And it's so bad that at one stage, the whole cabinet of Mali resigned because they were incapable of doing anything to contain the violence. And this latest incident just proves how difficult it is to put a stop to this.
So what is the cause of this conflict between these two ethnic groups?
Sometimes it's to do with people who have animals, who are settled farmers, fighting with people who have these huge herds of cattle and other animals that they kind of drive through people's farms, and they compete a lot for access to grazing and to water rights. But there's also been suggestions that the Fulani harbour jihadist groups. There are so many different jihadist groups in Mali, it's difficult to keep count of exactly how many there are. And the Fulani deny this vehemently, but there's no doubt about it that there's a lot of jihadist activity in Mali as well as these ethnic clashes.
So a lot of people dead in this attack. What chance that the perpetrators will be brought to justice?
It's very difficult. That's something that the Malians find really difficult, to actually track down these people. They disappear into the bush or into the forest or into the desert, and often they don't catch suspects at all. And also the Malian army is not that effective, and neither are the police. So in some, that sort of explains why the situation is so out of control.
Mary Harper.
Meanwhile, here in Britain, all eyes are on the race to be Prime Minister. 10 candidates have now put themselves forward to replace Theresa May. Brexit is, of course, top of their agenda, with Leavers and Remainers among the group. Among those announcing their bids this morning, for example, was the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock.
We need a leader not just for the next 6 weeks or 6 months, but for the next 6 years and beyond. We don't need a Leaver. We don't need a Remainer. We need a leader for the future.
Another high-profile candidate is the Foreign Secretary, Jeremy Hunt. Here's his approach to Brexit.
If we fight an election before delivering Brexit, we will be annihilated. Squeezed by the Brexit Party on the right and the Lib Dems on the left, we will simply allow Labour through the middle. And if that happened nationally, it would be the end of Brexit.
The front-runner, however, remains the candidate recently backed by Donald Trump, Boris Johnson. But whoever ends up in number 10, Brexit will dominate the next Prime Minister's agenda, and all the candidates have backed it, as our London correspondent Rob Watson explained to me.
Yes, they are. There was one candidate who thought that Brexit was a horrible mistake and therefore there should be a second referendum, but he has gone. So they're now all pro-Brexit. But what they haven't done is explain how on earth they would succeed where Theresa May has failed. I mean, there have been all sorts of fantastic promises and pledges ranging from leaving the European Union without a deal if absolutely necessary, despite the government's own predictions that that would be disastrous for the economy, all the way through to somehow renegotiating a better deal, although they haven't explained how they would do that where Theresa May failed with the EU.
OK, so let's leave Brexit to one side for now. How does the selection process work going forward?
Well, it is all about Brexit, but how does it work? Well, in the first instance, it's a sort of a two-stage process. First of all, the Conservative Party's MPs, they whittle it down from a list of 10 to 2. That's probably going to take a couple of weeks. And then the choice goes out to the wider Conservative Party membership, about 120,000 people. But here's what's going to strike plenty of people listening to us and here in this country is really weird. And that is that 120,000 Conservative Party activists who tend to be, you know, to the right of most normal voters and are more pro-Brexit than most ordinary voters get to choose the Prime Minister rather than the 45 million eligible voters who normally do that kind of thing.
And on that, why is Boris Johnson the favourite?
Why is he the favourite? So, for the reasons I said, really, that because of the electorate, if you think about it, is pro-Brexit, this Conservative Party activists pro-Brexit. And, you know, they think of him as being charismatic. They're terrified about Nigel Farage, the Brexit Party to the right, Jeremy Corbyn and the opposition Labour Party to the left. And they think, at last, you know, here's someone who's got a bit more spark and personality, let's face it, than Theresa May. But he has, of course, these massive black marks against him beyond the Conservative Party membership, which briefly are, number one, that most of the 48% of the people who voted Remain think he's a thorough chancer and wouldn't touch him with a barge pole. Secondly, he said things like F business, not very wise for a bro business party. And thirdly, an awful lot of people in his own party and many of the UK's allies just think that he's not the kind of person who's really fit for high office.
Rob Watson. Who'll follow President Trump? Well, Democrats will have their own ideas, but for Republicans, thoughts are turning to a possible successor. One name being mentioned is Mike Pompeo, the former Kansas congressman who's now US Secretary of State. That means he already enjoys an international profile. The diplomacy over Iran accompanying President Trump on the recent state visit to the UK and so on. But he also seems to be cultivating his domestic profile. He's been back to Kansas talking to Republicans about a possible run for the US Senate. Tara McKelvey has been to Wichita, where Mr. Pompeo used to live, to find out whether people there see him as a future president.
Pompeo is I call it a soundboard, you know. It just bounces back off. So I really believe one day, he's going to be president.
That's Joseph Elmore, the chairman of a Wichita Republican group. I met him at a lunch for Republicans at the Pachyderm Club. Mr. Pompeo used to come here when he lived in the city and helped to run an aerospace company. After their customary Pledge of Allegiance, other diners say they admire Mr. Pompeo's military background, his Christian faith, and his talent as a leader.
Mike, physically, he's a kind of an imposing guy. He's big and burly. He's got a military background in leadership roles. That brings some more of that flavor to it.
So we're a manufacturing town with a lot of ag influence, obviously. It's a good Midwest values city.
Across town, I meet Walter Berry, the head of a company that sells construction equipment to farmers. Mr. Berry is like other Kansas conservatives. He believes in low taxes and small government. And he thinks Mr. Pompeo is the right kind of leader for the Republican Party.
I do think that a lot of Trump's voters, and I probably fall into that category, weren't so much I was voting for Trump, but I was voting against his opponent. And so if we had somebody who didn't have all of the rough edges that Trump has, but had the positive conservative and articulate the vision, then I think they would get even greater support.
At a cafe, I talked to Devaney Elliott, a Democrat. She's hardly a fan of Mr. Pompeo, but she can see how he'd appeal to conservatives, and that makes her nervous.
I worry about anybody in Trump's circle that has the ability to project an aura of congeniality, of sanity, of calmness, because they share the same values, but they don't announce them as loudly.
We've seen launches of Iranian missiles out of Yemen by the Houthi proxy forces. These are the kinds of activity that are incredibly destabilizing in the Middle East, and they are among the primary aims of our counter-Iran policy.
That was Mr. Pompeo using tough rhetoric about Iran on a show hosted by a presenter, Hugh Hewitt. Mr. Pompeo speaks in a more deliberate manner than Mr. Trump and doesn't swear, but he's just as hard-line. When he was nominated as CIA director in 2017, human rights advocates were upset. Sarah Margon of Human Rights Watch said that Mr. Pompeo had spoken ambiguously about torture.
Our concern with now Secretary Pompeo is that he might have been willing to bend or break the law in order to do something he thought would be effective.
Sarah Margon of Human Rights Watch ending that report by Tara McKelvey. Now to New York City, where a helicopter has crashed onto the roof of a high-rise building. One person is reported to have been killed in the accident. Nick Bryant has the details.
The helicopter crash-landed on the roof of a building in midtown Manhattan, close to Times Square, an area where the cityscape is crowded with skyscrapers and the streets are crowded with tourists. The weather in New York today is atrocious, with low visibility, and the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, who was on the scene shortly afterwards, said it appeared the helicopter was forced to make an emergency landing. After the crash, there was a fire on the roof of the 50-story building, but teams of firefighters are believed to have it under control. Workers in the skyscraper on 7th Avenue said the entire building shook, but there have been no reports of debris falling onto the streets. From ground level, there are no obvious signs of damage.
Nick Bryant. Still to come in this edition of our podcast.
In truth, beneath the surface, they're withdrawing from high seas whaling, from whaling around Antarctica, from whaling in the North Pacific, and from their long-running sham of scientific whaling.
Why is Japan defying the global ban on whaling? In the aftermath of the fall of the Islamic State group, the Iraqi authorities have been facing an enormous challenge, bringing to justice thousands of people suspected of belonging to the group, and that includes thousands of fighters from at least 50 countries. The judicial processes being used have been criticised by some, particularly those ending with the death penalty. Now, the United Nations has sent an investigative team to assist the local judiciary in the investigation and prosecution of some of the crimes committed by IS. Razia Iqbal has been speaking to the head of that team, the UN Special Advisor Karim Assad Ahmed Khan, QC.
Well, the scope of our work in Iraq is to investigate crimes by Daesh, ISIL, that may constitute the crimes of genocide, crimes against humanity or war crimes. So we've been created by the Security Council as an independent investigative team charged with ensuring credible investigations that lead to fair trials in terms of exhumations, investigations, forensics, legal analysis, so we can hopefully ensure proper accountability.
So there already have been many trials that have been held. The government, the Iraqi government, says approximately 2,900. So just under 3,000 trials have been completed with a conviction rate of about 98%. There is a perception, particularly inside Iraq, but also outside, that these trials are rushed, some of them lasting only a few minutes, and in some cases that torture has been used to elicit confessions. Do you think that that is a fair characterization of what's happened to date?
I think Iraq has had a massive wound, and it's been trying to build a legal system that meets international standards. Now, whilst many trials have taken place, it's important to note those trials have taken place relating to terrorism. No trial has taken place so far for either genocide, crimes against humanity and war crimes. Now, it's very much a work in progress. Any country, whether it's the United Kingdom or France, if suddenly you have hundreds of thousands of individuals that may have some kind of responsibility, it's a massive challenge to investigate and have fair trials. But I think there's been some improvement. Human Rights Watch have noted that there's some improvements in some of the courts, for example, the Kark court in Mosul. But of course, there are challenges that remain. Where I commend the government of Iraq is it recognises things need to improve, it needs some capacity, it needs some assistance, and that's why also we are here.
Given the criticisms that have been levelled at the Iraqi government with relation to those trials that have taken place to date, I wonder if you think that it's the right thing to do to even build an infrastructure inside Iraq, that perhaps it should be outside the country, that there should be some international jurisdiction.
I think that would be the worst possible advice that could be given. A proper functioning legal system is essential, not only for Daesh accountability, but for stability in a country. Not only will there be no development, there'll be this black hole that will suck every ounce of hope from the people and would lead to fragmentation and complete chaos. So I think one has to support national authorities, whether they're the government of Iraq, which is trying to deal with the Daesh members that are in custody, or whether it's Germany that's dealing with foreign terrorist fighters.
What's your view of the fact that there are, of course, many Western countries who refuse to take those people who have volunteered to join the Islamic State group? Do you think that those people should be tried in Iraq? Because clearly there are some Western countries who are thinking about setting up courts in their own domains.
The scale of the problem is so immense, no one court, in all honesty, can deal with the scale and gravity of the criminality that we have seen. So those countries like Germany that are taking back foreign fighters, UNITAD is here to assist them, to collect evidence that can hopefully feed into fair and independent trials in Germany. Those countries like Iraq that have many, we need to try to assist them to raise the bar in terms of capacity building and fair trials.
UN Special Advisor Karim Assad Ahmad Khan, QC, talking to Razia Iqbal. Over the past decade, discussion over gender identity has gone mainstream, even affecting policies within traditional sectors like the military. But according to the Vatican, debating gender identity may, in their words, annihilate the concept of nature. In a new document from the Congregation for Catholic Education, entitled Male and Female, He Created Them, the Church accuses ideas around gender fluidity of causing an educational crisis and destabilising family as an institution. Our religion editor Martin Bashir has this report.
The Vatican's decision to intervene in this contentious area has been prompted by Catholic teachers who've been appealing for advice and guidance on how best to discuss the issue of gender identity with young people. The document offers a critique of what it says is the postmodern approach, which argues that gender can be chosen and changed over time. It goes on to assert that gender is assigned by God. The Holy Scriptures, it says, reveal the wisdom of the Creator's design. It also accuses those who promote discussion of gender identity of being unquestioning and absolutist, even dictating how children should be raised. But Dr. Jane Hamlin, an academic who leads the Beaumont Society, the UK's longest established transgender support group, says the report fails to understand what transgender people face.
No one I know chooses to be trans. I mean, why would they? I mean, because the only choice that trans people I know, and I know plenty of them, the only choice they have is whether or not to continue hiding it from other people. I mean, do you hide it and endure the torments alone, or talk about it and then risk rejection by your family and friends? It's a reality for too many people, unfortunately.
The document concedes that the Church has long tolerated discrimination and says that in order to provide coherent education programmes, it must be consistent with what it calls the true nature of human persons. But New Ways Ministry, an American organisation that works with LGBT Catholics, has described the document as a harmful tool that will be used to oppress and says it will encourage hatred, bigotry and violence.
Martin Bashir. Japan is soon to begin its controversial practice of commercial whaling again. According to reports, the first boats will set off on the 1st of July. Commercial whaling was banned around the world in 1982. The moratorium came into force 4 years later, and since 1988, Japan has only hunted whales for what it calls scientific research. But last year, the country pulled out of that accord. So what will the resumption mean for whale conservation? James Menendez has been speaking to Patrick Ramage of the International Fund for Animal Welfare, and he says it could, unexpectedly, be good news for whales.
They say that they're withdrawing from the International Whaling Commission. In truth, beneath the surface, they're withdrawing from high seas whaling, from whaling around Antarctica, from whaling in the North Pacific, and from their long-running sham of scientific whaling. So while it's never welcome when a great nation like Japan abandons an international conservation convention, the actual impact of this announcement means good things for whales, good things for the commission, and good things for the great nation of Japan.
In terms of the amount of whales that are likely to be caught, will there be much difference to previous years when it has been done under this guise of scientific research? Are you expecting it to be about the same number?
Well, we've seen a steady decline. We expect that decline to continue. From several thousand whales of several species around Antarctica in the early 90s, Japan this year killed 333 minke whales, the smallest of the great whale species, in the waters of the Antarctic Whale Sanctuary, which Japan has annually defied, a couple hundred whales in the North Pacific. As best we can glean, there will be a continued reduction in the number of whales killed, and that's been the case certainly since the International Court of Justice found Japan's scientific whaling illegal.
Japan, of course, has always maintained that it's an important industry for the country, that there is a cultural element too, and that a sustainable whaling industry is possible. Are they not right?
I think it's rubbish. Certainly, Japan has a proud maritime history. And like so many nations around the world, my own, the United States, the United Kingdom, whaling was an important part of our economies and culture in an earlier time. To suggest that Japan is somehow unable to reconcile itself to an era of whale conservation instead of whale killing, one has to either be an apologist for a nationalist political agenda or a government bureaucrat eager to retain budget and influence in an outmoded activity.
That was Patrick Ramage, the Director of Marine Conservation at the International Fund for Animal Welfare. And we end on proof that a good wine will indeed stand the test of time, as scientists have found that a wine being drunk at the time of the Battle of Hastings in 1066 could have been the same as that we drink today, more than 900 years later. Our science correspondent Helen Briggs told me more about how this was uncovered.
It all relies on some grape seeds that were dug up at archaeological sites around France, these sort of shriveled little grape seeds. They analysed the DNA, and that bit of DNA detective work meant they could match them to this massive genetic database of the grapes we use for wine today, and found some matches. So they found a match for a wine that's still drunk today in parts of France from 900 years ago. And they could also go back in time and look at what the Romans were growing in their vineyards. And these are very closely related to some of today's wines like Syrah and Pinot Noir. Now, can't be 100% sure that these grapes were used for wine, but they're the sort that would lend themselves to winemaking and wouldn't have tasted very nice to eat as table grapes. So they're pretty sure that some of these wines go back centuries.
But even if the grapes were similar, surely the processes that are used in winemaking today, are they the same as those that would have been used all that time ago?
Well, apparently the Romans actually had a lot of knowledge of winemaking, and they gave specific Latin names to different grape varieties. So scientists have long suspected that this could have been going on, but we don't have the proof. But what we can do is look at grapevines, because these are propagated by cutting. So you're essentially cloning a grapevine. So it does mean that the grapes that you could drink today in a glass of wine in parts of France are actually from the same ancestral plant as those 900 years ago, because they've just been propagated by cuttings and they're essentially clones. So they are the same grape. In terms of the Roman grapes, they're very closely related. They're more like sisters or cousins. But again, a unique insight into wine lovers all of those centuries ago.
So perhaps proof that a good wine really will stand the test of time.
Absolutely. And the scientists do want to go further back again. And they say that actually there could be some clues if they find more grapes that seem to be grown then. Maybe we could bring them back. Maybe there's something very special out there that we haven't found yet.
Helen Briggs. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. Before we go, let me tell you about the BBC World Service's landmark podcast series, 13 Minutes to the Moon, which tells the story of the Apollo moon landings. Presenter Kevin Fong has been talking to the people who made the landings happen. They describe how they overcame numerous challenges before Neil Armstrong could make his first steps on the moon. 13 Minutes to the Moon tells the story behind one of the most iconic events of the 20th century. Just search for 13 Minutes to the Moon wherever you get your podcasts. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.